That is our job, Dave.
Podcasting from an underground studio flying under the radar, this is Dan. By day, I'm a professor of cognitive neuroscience, and by night, I retreat into my subterranean lair and dig deep into the thoughts of mankind.
I like to say people kind, not necessarily mankind, because it's more inclusive.
There we go, exactly.
And I'm Dave, sitting firmly atop the Great Canadian Shield in Northern Ontario. I'm a pastor by profession, and a part of that includes unmasking the messaging that comes at us each and every day.
We will not conform.
You're listening to the Not Conformed Podcast.
We welcome our listeners to episode one of the Not Conformed Podcast. Dave, how are things in the Great White North?
Cold. Cold. We've been getting really nasty. Not as cold as Winnipeg, but we've been getting some really cold weather up here. So I've got a mug of matcha here. I'm just gonna, you can hear it here. I'm just gonna swish it up here with my matcha brush.
Oh, that's
and,
nice.
I'm trying not to bump the table too much as I take some sips out of this thing as we talk about propaganda and the media, episode one. And
now you're making me want some matcha.
Well, you better put the thing on pause and get some then if you want.
All right. Now let's move forward. So today we want to focus on the mainstream media and examine to what extent they present a reasonably faithful picture of what's happening in the world. And I suspect that many people out there believe that the information they get from the mainstream media accurately reflects the unbiased truth, or at least a relatively unbiased truth, about what's going on in the world. And so, Dave, do you get the same sense from the folks that you meet?
Yes, I do, unfortunately. I think a lot of people have succumbed to what some are calling the Trump derangement syndrome. And, you know, they're stressed out about the latest thing that President Trump is alleged to have done or said, and really just parroting the talking points of the mainstream media without asking any questions. And it affects their worldview. It affects their psychological well-being as well. And it's sad to see.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because maybe if you ask people, do you believe everything the media says, they might say, well, not really. So they might say that they don't fully trust the media. But when you hear what they're saying and they're constantly parroting the media talking points, it's clear that they do trust the media, at least implicitly.
Yeah, exactly. People believe that sources like the New York Times, that they provide a true and relatively unbiased perspective of world events.
It's interesting. One of my kids mentioned that her high school teacher repeatedly argued that the CBC News, this is Canadian, is an unbiased Canadian news source. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, that's maybe at the end of the episode we can look into Trudeau's funding of the CBC, but it's bizarre.
Yeah. I think that there are people who listen to and watch the mainstream media, and based on the information presented, they form a view of the world. But is that information faithful, the information that they're receiving, faithful to what is actually going on in the world?
And we hope to unpack this for you. Dan, you and I, we grew up behind the Iron Curtain, being born back in Czechoslovakia. And it was just, you know, back then there was no light at the end of the tunnel before we got out in the early 80s. And everybody knew that what you were getting from the television or wherever, that it was in the newspaper, that it was government propaganda. And so people were in some ways inoculated against it.
Yeah, everybody sort of recognized that the media is probably telling you something that's false.
Exactly. And by that, people were a little bit inoculated against the propaganda. Whereas what's kind of interesting here, and I, you know, Dad pointing this out all along, is that people aren't inoculated against that. And then so they're much more susceptible to the media messaging.
Yeah.
You know, like back then, you'd have a phone, but you knew that somebody was listening on the other side. So not the other side, but in the middle, right? So you'd be careful what you said about it. And we're slowly realizing that we have to take that same perspective, that same worldview here. But I think people are still very slow and reluctant to come to that understanding.
Yeah, I remember Dave.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I remember Mom actually saying one time that back in the Czech Republic, back then it was Czechoslovakia, people saw the news, they sort of categorized into three categories. The news that was probably true, the news that was maybe true, and the news that was clearly false. And so the news that was probably true were the sports. The news that were possibly or maybe true, that was the weather. And the news that was certainly false was everything else.
Everything else. Yeah, that's right. That's right. I remember that, yeah. And you got me into this a few years back. And we, growing up here in Canada, kind of got used to a certain worldview that everything was moving along hunky-dory, that there was progress. You know, if science was hadn't had the answers today, would have the answers tomorrow. And so we had this kind of, you know, we could call it promissory materialism on the one hand and a historical chauvinism on the other hand, that we're somehow superior. Everybody else before us was an idiot.
Yeah.
And you get older and you start to question that. And I think it's only been, with respect to propaganda in the media, is it's only been recently in the Trump era that you really start to see and you're able to easily document for yourself how biased and how one-sided messaging the media is.
Yeah, because of course it's Donald Trump who really started to question the trustworthiness of the media, right? And actually I have a clip here of his vitriolic condemnation of, well, for one, on the one hand, intelligence agencies, but also, on the other hand, the mainstream media.
I think it was disgraceful that the intelligence agencies allowed any information that turned out to be so false and fake out. I think it's a disgrace. And I say that. And that's something that Nazi Germany would
Nazi
have done
Germany.
And did do. I think it's a disgrace. Yeah. That information that was false and fake and never happened got released to the public. As far as BuzzFeed, which is a failing pile of garbage, writing it, I think they're going to suffer the consequences. They already are. And as far as CNN going out of their way to build it up.
So he's calling out the intelligence agencies, equating them with Nazi intelligence agencies, presumably because they share the same propaganda tactics, at least in Donald Trump's mind. And then he links the intelligence agencies with the media, because of course it's the information came out through the media. And I think we're going to return to this topic with the intelligence agencies and the media in maybe the next episode or the one after that. But at the end, he clearly accuses the mainstream media agencies like BuzzFeed and CNN of peddling propaganda. So here is the media's point of view. And this is a segment featuring Brian Stelter of CNN as he does a year in review at the end of the year that was 2018.
If we're being honest, President Trump sometimes behaves like an internet troll, spreading conspiracy theories and bogus Twitter memes and faulty narratives. In 2018, we saw year two of Trump turning reality upside down in that way, completely on its head, and distorting and confusing a lot of people. This makes journalists' jobs much tougher, but also thrilling, because we have to constantly be on our toes, and we have to constantly be fact-checking. In effect, with all of the president's anti-media messages, he is leading a hate movement against the media.
Hate movement?
It is that serious. He's whipping up hatred at his rallies and on his Twitter feed. But here's the thing. He's not our customer. You are. Viewers are. And despite his attacks, we need to make sure we keep serving you with straight talk about what's going on, what's going wrong, and what's going right. For example, by calling a lie a lie.
And of course, the lie that he's going to call out is Trump's lie. But you notice the quote here, we give you the straight talk and the truth. So in effect, he's saying, we expose Trump's lies, he's false, he's telling you false things, and we, the media, are going to tell you the truth. And, of course, the question is, what would Trump's response to that be?
You are fake news.
That's right. Yeah, that's a great clip. And what we see happening is people typically are going to take one of the two sides. And what's missed here is that the conflict is framed, the way it's framed is a false dichotomy, as if there were, it was one of the two sides, one right and the other wrong. And if you're on one side, the other one's wrong. And what's missed is the possibility that both sides are distorting the truth.
Yeah. So what you basically have here is a case where both sides might be peddling propaganda. So the Trump media conflict could be construed as essentially a battle of propaganda. And I've been using that word a few times, so we should probably define this, Dave. So according to the Google Dictionary, it defines propaganda as information, especially of a biased or misleading nature, used to promote or publicize a particular political cause or point of view. And we're going to return to this issue of defining propaganda in a next episode, but we'll stick with this one for now.
CNN's news coverage of Trump is clearly biased. It's against him. I was looking up, people have been citing all kinds of numbers, but just if you just Google Trump coverage biased, you'll get stuff like study 91% of network coverage has been negative. That's Washington Post, Washington Times, 90% of coverage is negative.
Wow.
So they're obviously biased against him, right?
Yeah.
But on the other hand, Trump also seems to exaggerate and skew things for his own benefit, right? I don't know if you've got that that clip there, but the nobody does it better. Yeah. You guys have probably seen it on the internet. It's amazing.
Yeah, here you go. Thanks.
Nobody can do it like me. Nobody. Nobody can do it like me.
Nobody.
Honestly.
Nobody's stronger than me.
Nobody has better toys than I do.
There's nobody bigger or better at the military than I am.
Nobody loves the Bible more than I do.
Nobody builds walls better than me.
Nobody's better to people with disabilities than me.
Nobody's fighting for the veterans like I'm fighting for the veterans.
There's nobody that's done so much for equality as I have.
There's nobody more pro-Israel than I am.
There's nobody more conservative than me.
There is nobody that respects women more than I do.
Nobody would be tougher on ISIS than Donald Trump.
There's nobody's ever had crowds like Trump has had.
There's nobody that understands the horror of nuclear better than me.
Okay. Nobody even understands it,
it goes
it but
on
me.
There.
It's called devaluation.
The sale of the uranium.
it does go on and on.
It goes on. I mean, you could make this probably quite long if you wanted to. And of course, Trump is engaging in hyperbole. That's anybody that has any sense would understand that. But the point is that they're both engaging in propaganda. They're both doing that, using information to promote or publicize a political point of view or a political cause or point of view.
Yeah. So I guess that most people would say, okay, well, Trump, he's a politician. He's going to be a little bit biased. But the news media ought to be or is objective and truthful. So let's focus for a minute just on the media. We'll put Trump aside, whatever you think about him, and focus just on the media. And, when I tell people and I tell my students sometimes that the media are inherently peddlers of propaganda, they look at me as if I'm some sort of a conspiracy theorist. They look at me as if I have two heads or something. And
so how do you deal with that? How do you, what's the best way to break in there?
Well, one thing that I do is I pull out an interview with one of the main academic critics of the media. And this academic is none other than Noam Chomsky.
I remember Chomsky from undergrad, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. If you maybe took a course in psychology or linguistics, you would have come across Chomsky because he made some major contributions to the study of language. And I don't know if you remember this, Dave, but he had this big debate with the big behaviorist B.F. Skinner about how language was acquired. And of course, Chomsky won that hands down. I mean, he was very clearly the winner in that debate. But after that, and this is where it gets interesting, he spent his later career commenting on political and global issues. And some of the work that he did focused on analyzing propaganda in the news media. And he wrote a whole bunch of books on this, but I was able to find some clips in which Chomsky was interviewed by a journalist, Andrew Marr. And the interview was aired by the BBC in 1996, over 20 years ago. And so the audio is not great. There's lots of hiss in the background. But I think these clips are worth discussing because they have some very interesting information. And sometimes I play some of this for my students and it's quite eye-opening for them. So I'll play the first clip here. And at this point in the interview, Andrew Marr asks Chomsky about his propaganda model of the news media. And here's a part of Chomsky's response.
The institutional structure of the media is quite straightforward. We're talking about the United States, but it's not very different elsewhere. There are sectors, but the agenda-setting media, the ones that sort of set the framework for everyone else, like the New York Times and the Washington Post and so on, these are major corporations, parts of even bigger conglomerates, like other corporate institutions, they have a product and a market. Their market is advertisers, that is, other businesses. Their product is relatively privileged audiences, more or less.
So they're selling audiences to
They're selling privileged audiences. These are big corporations selling privileged audiences to other corporations. Now the question is, what picture of the world would a rational person expect to come out of this structure? And then we draw some conclusions about what you'd expect, and then we check, and yes, that's the picture of the world that comes out.
So Chomsky's talking about is what he calls the propaganda model of the news media. And the basic idea, as you might have heard there, is that the media have a particular institutional structure that inherently causes them to be heavily biased. And the basic structure there is that they are essentially big businesses. They have a power structure. And so the media serves that power structure, and their main basically business is to sell audiences to other big businesses.
Yeah, I think he makes a great point there. And if you caught it in the Stelter clip that you played a little bit earlier, he inadvertently kind of stumbles into this when he says, you know, you are our customer. We're here to give you the straight talk, right? Now, if you just think about that for a moment, that's complete misdirection, because you are not the customer. The customer is the one who pays. None of us pay to watch CNN. CNN doesn't receive directly any of our revenue. What they use is our eyeballs or our ears to sell that to the advertisers, who then pay CNN and others for that privilege to be able to advertise and sell product to us, right?
Yeah. So
it's a nice piece of misdirection there by Stelter, but if you think about it, it's exactly what the real model is exactly what Chomsky's talking about here.
Oh, that's an amazing catch. Yeah, he actually said, I remember this now, he actually says that you're our customer. Yeah.
Yeah, he talked to the audience, right? Like you, the listener, he says. But that's misdirection. Look, I got an article here by CNN boss. Not by him, sorry. It's an article on the Hill from an interview by Jeff Zucker. And he says, look, we've seen time and time again, we've seen that anytime you break away from the Trump story and cover other events in this area, the audience goes away, right? And they're lamenting, oh, people don't want to hear more Trump coverage. But these guys made a decision, for financial decision, to cover Trump. And as we know, as others have pointed out, CNN is heavily, heavily anti-Trump.
Yeah.
It's a business decision because that's what gets them the audience. That
they make
can
money.
Serve up to the advertisers, right?
Yeah, they make money from that. Now, if you're like me, I guess the question I would ask of Chomsky would be, how do you possibly get so many separate media outlets coordinating their messaging? Because if you're going to have this systematic propaganda message, how are all these media outlets coordinating their message? Chomsky, in his books, answers this question, actually. And I think they can be summarized in three key points. And the first one is that surprisingly, there are simply not as many separate media outlets as you may think there are. And he makes the case, and I'm looking at his book here. It's called Manufacturing Consent. It's a big, ginormous tome. It was published in 1980s, I think, and then updated in 2002. It's co-authored with Edward Herman. And he makes the case that the media is becoming monopolized. In the early 80s, there were about 50 big media firms in the U.S. But by the turn of the century, so that was year 2000, there were only 9. So you went from 50 to 9. So there are not as many separate media businesses. And here's a quote from Manufacturing Consent. And I'll just find the page here. I got the book right here.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a quote.
Okay.
Since 1990, a wave of massive deals and rapid globalization have left the media industries further centralized in 9 transnational conglomerates. Disney, AOL Time Warner, Viacom, owner of CBS, News Corporation, Bertelsmann, General Electric, owner of NBC, Sony, AT&T Liberty Media, and Vivendi Universal. These giants own all the world's major film studios, TV networks, and music companies, and a sizable fraction of the most important cable channels, cable systems, magazines, major market TV stations, and book publishers, end quote. So you see, they're not just in the news, into news. They're also, they own movies. They own TV stations. They're in books and probably magazines. I mean, these guys are everywhere.
But basically, everything that can convey a message has been bought up so that the message can be consistent.
Yes.
Right?
And so, and here's a key point. While it may seem that there are lots of independent voices out there competing in the marketplace of ideas, there are actually fewer than you think, and actually can boil down to maybe 9. And that was in like 2002. So it could even be fewer now, you know, major businesses that run all these different outlets.
Yeah, and there's one quick point that could be made here is that we've seen, since Chomsky wrote this, an expansion of alternate media on the internet. But you'll notice that is precisely why there is such a war on alternate media sources right now on the internet, is to gain back the control that they had with all these consolidations.
Yes, and not only are there fewer outlets or fewer businesses running things, those fewer outlets are actually not truly independent. There are what Chomsky calls the agenda-setting media, such as the New York Times and the Washington Post. And I was listening to one of his talks, and he claimed that the small outlets are told what the leading stories in the agenda-setting outlets will be, and this way they could coordinate their programming and focus on the quote-unquote important stories that are to come out the next day. And so the basic idea is here, they're not even independent. There's a few that take the lead and the others follow. And I guess the third key point here is that the media outlets also now depend on a few centralized sources of news. And I'm thinking of the Associated Press, for instance.
Yeah.
Because they feed the news to many different outlets. And Chomsky, he has a quote here in his book. I got to grab the book here again. This is what he writes, quote, "Media centralization and the reduction in the resources devoted to journalism have made the media more dependent than ever on the primary definers who both make the news and subsidize the media by providing accessible and cheap copy." Right. So they're basically, they make the copy, they make news articles, and then they just disseminate it to the other outlets. And sometimes those other outlets just take it word for word.
Yeah. And perhaps the best example of that, or something that falls into the space anyways, is the, I don't know if you have it in the, I put a clip into the folder there, the Sinclair Media clip. Now, many people have probably seen this already, but just to set it up, it's best done when it's visual, but you'll get a little bit of it in the on the audio version, that Sinclair Media, which is responsible for something like 200 media sources, localized little networks, put out central talking points that then were read by people all over the country. And this is an example of the conservative side of the aisle doing this, but you could just as easily find the same kind of collusion on the leftist side of the aisle as well.
Hi, I'm Fox San Antonio's Jessica Headley.
And I'm Ryan Wolf.
Our greatest responsibility is to serve our Treasure Valley communities.
The El Paso, Las Cruces communities.
Eastern Iowa communities.
Mid-Michigan communities.
We are extremely proud of the quality, balanced journalism that CBS 4 News produces.
But we are concerned about troublemaking the irresponsible one-sided news stories plaguing our country.
The sharing of biased and false news has become all too common on social media. More alarming, some media outlets publish these same fake stories without checking facts first.
The sharing of biased and false news
has become all too common on social media. More alarming,
some media. Wow, I mean, they're singing from the same playbook.
Yeah.
Wow. But it's word for word coordination.
Yeah, go ahead and just get the clip off. But it doesn't make good podcasting or good radio, but you really got to see it. Just Google Sinclair script and you'll see they're all on the screen side by side by side. And eventually there's a whole slew of them on the screen talking from the exact same script, each with their own little emphasis and emotional weighting, but really just teleprompter reading, which is basically what most of the news is teleprompter reading.
Yeah, exactly. It's not like these people are sitting there or standing there extemporaneously delivering information like we are. What they're that's doing right. is reading from a script that's been provided to them by somebody else, by some central source.
That's right. And most of the smoothness that you see on the media is simply because of that, because these people are simply teleprompter readers.
Yeah, exactly. And here we are right? tripping over ourselves.
Yeah, when they go off script, you get those New Year's party things, and then it just goes completely bizarre. Right?
Or Stelter tells you that you're the customer.
Yeah.
No, that was probably scripted.
Yeah. Actually, maybe it was actually because the way he was so earnest about the fact that you, the listener, the customer, I'm sure that was written right into the script. Because remember, that's misdirection. You're not the customer.
That's right. You're right.
You're the product being delivered to the customer.
No, I totally agree. That was probably right on the script. But did you hear in that clip, I don't know if you remember, but you hear all this background noise. It's like they've lost some of their professionalism. They got people giggling in the background. You know, they can't even keep their studio quiet anymore over at CNN.
No, I'll have to listen to that again to catch that. I didn't catch that.
Yeah, so let's move on to another part of this Chomsky interview as he's talking about the propaganda model. Here's another short clip.
And is this anything more than the idea that basically the press is relatively right-wing, with some exceptions, because it's owned by big business, which...
And by the way, Marr is just saying here, again, that because Chomsky makes the general point that the media is a big business and so it's going to be biased. Marr says, is that just making the same point that basically the media is capitalist right-wing, right? That they have this capitalist right-wing bias.
Well, I would call the press relatively liberal. Here I agree with the right-wing critics. So especially the New York Times and the Washington Post, which are called, without a trace of irony, the New York Times is called the establishment left in, say, major foreign policy journals. And that's correct, but what's not recognized is that the role of the liberal intellectual establishment is to set very sharp bounds on how far you can go, this far and no further.
Now, I think there's a very interesting side point here. Marr notes that the media is essentially capitalist and right-wing because they are big business, and that's what I mentioned earlier. But Chomsky says, well, some big media outlets, the New York Times and maybe the Washington Post, they are actually left-wing liberal in their messaging. So it's not like there is, on the one hand, the left-wing media, all controlled by the liberals, and on the other hand, the right-wing media, all controlled by the capitalists. What you're seeing here, and I think this will blow the minds of some of our listeners, what you're seeing here is a hand-in-glove relationship wherein the left and right are working together. You have capitalist interest owning the media, but the messaging is under liberal control. The messaging is liberal. And I think that's fascinating because, you see, it's blurring the lines between the left and the right, between the capitalist and the leftist. And
Maybe down the line we can get a little bit more into details on this, but essentially the dichotomy that we've been presented is even a manufactured one.
That's right. It's right? a false opposition.
The reality is that you've got careful control of what spectrum of ideas is presented out there, and you can't, you know, you're within a certain set of boundaries, whether you're on the right or you're on the left. There is this intellectual elite control of the media that is that wants to control both sides, essentially.
Yeah, and later on, we have to get into the work of, I'm thinking of Anthony Sutton.
Right.
And he describes how the New York bankers, who are supposed to be capitalists, so they're right wing, okay, and how they funded the Bolsheviks in their revolution, the Bolshevik Revolution. Of course, the Bolsheviks, they were, of course, uber communist. So they were very left wing. So here you have the left and the right are not two competing forces, But behind the scenes, they seem to be working together. And this is completely mind-blowing. I think this understanding that is a paradigm-shifting understanding. And here you see that alluded to a little bit here in the Chomsky quote. But I agree that that the key point to take away from this for our present purposes is that you have this, what Chomsky calls the quote, liberal intellectual establishment setting the bounds and controlling what can be put out there.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you have some good examples from Chomsky on this one.
Yeah, I have some good example of media bias from Chomsky.
Okay. Well, let's move on to that then.
Okay.
Why don't we take a look at that?
All right. So here is one example, and I have this very short clip here from Chomsky, and then I'll explain it. Here we go.
Okay, let's look at one of the other key examples, which you've looked at too, which would appear to go against your idea, which is the Watergate.
Watergate is a perfect example. We've discussed it at length in our book, in fact, and elsewhere.
Indeed.
It's a perfect example of the way the press was subordinated to power.
But this brought down a president.
Let me give you just a minute. Let's take a look. What happened there, here it's kind of interesting, because you can't do experiments in history. But here history was kind enough to set one up for us. The Watergate exposures happened to take place at exactly the same time as another set of exposures, namely the exposures of COINTELPRO.
Oh, sorry, you have to explain that.
It's interesting that I have to explain it because it's vastly more significant than Watergate. That already makes my point.
So for our listeners, especially for our young listeners, Watergate refers to the scandal where a group of guys broke into the offices of the Democratic National Committee, the DNC, and these guys were later linked to then-President Richard Nixon, who was a Republican. And of course, that was a big scandal. Later, Nixon got into even more trouble. And ultimately, it all added up and he was forced to resign. But Watergate was big in the news. And even some of our young listeners, maybe in their history class, learned about Watergate. But at the exact same time, Chomsky says, there's this event that occurred, another exposure, which was COINTELPRO. And you notice here, Andrew Marr has no knowledge of what COINTELPRO is, which Chomsky says that itself is actually telling. But COINTELPRO stands for Counterintelligence Program, and it was an FBI covert program to infiltrate and influence U.S. political movements. And these would have been some of the more liberating movements at the time, so the black social movements, the civil rights movements, and so on. And basically, they were infiltrating them, monitoring them, and politically influencing them, and so on. So this was a massive thing, and it unfolded over a lot of time. And the big point here is that these events came out at the same time, but people mostly heard about Watergate, which was this petty office break-in blown up to be this big thing, but very few people heard about COINTELPRO. And even though COINTELPRO was much more significant. And that is an example of the kind of bias the media has. And of course, the question is why? Why would it be the case that there would be this bias? And I have a quote here from Chomsky.
In Watergate, Richard Nixon went after half of U.S. private power, namely the Democratic Party, and power can defend itself. So therefore, that's a scandal. He didn't do anything. Nothing happened. Look, I was on Nixon's enemies list. I didn't even know. Nothing ever happened.
So, the civil rights movements that were affected by COINTELPRO, they didn't have the power to influence the media, right? They were just these people movements. But in Watergate, you basically had the Democrats being affected and potentially some sensitive information being stolen or released. So half of U.S. politics was being influenced, and they have the power to influence media, and in that case, trigger this big hoopla about the events of Watergate.
Yeah, and the other thing there is to point out that part of what's going on is this technique of misdirection that we saw Stelter use just a little bit earlier, and they do this all the time, is focusing on some minor thing, right, that matters to you, and as Chomsky points out, it affected half the money and power in the U.S. And so that way you can focus on that while completely ignoring the other big thing that is maybe much more major in its impact, but making sure that doesn't get much attention.
And in his book, Manufacturing Consent, Chomsky describes many other examples of these sorts of biased media coverage. And one that's worth discussing here is the biased media coverage of third world elections. And maybe that's especially apropos with regard to what's going on in the world right now.
Before you jump in, Dan, I just wanted to make one more point about this Watergate and COINTELPRO is that this is a good example of seeing how things sort of shake out. And we could pull out something that's much more controversial because it's much more recent. But there's enough information on these two issues, and as Chomsky kind of unpacks them, this isn't something that he's saying that's is really controversial or conspiracy. In fact, kind of the word conspiracy comes into play to sideline anybody that's pointing out some of these kinds of things down the line. But when we look at them historically, we've got some perspective. There's a little bit of time and place, and you can, some documents have leaked out. People understand better what Watergate was. And there's obviously documents that have leaked out and been declassified on COINTELPRO as well. So you can do this kind of analysis looking back. And perhaps then see, oh, if they did it then, maybe they're also doing it now.
Exactly. It's not like probably things have changed very much over time in this regard. So here's a quote about the third world elections. Here's a quote. "We show that the mainstream media have followed a government agenda in treating elections in client and disfavored states. In El Salvador in the 1980s, the U.S. government sponsored several elections to demonstrate to the U.S. public that our intervention there was approved by the local population. Whereas when Nicaragua held an election in 1984, the Reagan administration tried to discredit it to prevent legitimation of a government the administration was trying to overthrow. The mainstream media cooperated, finding the Salvadoran election a step toward democracy and the Nicaraguan election a sham, despite the fact that electoral conditions were far more compatible with an honest election in Nicaragua than in El Salvador. We demonstrate that the media applied a remarkable dual standard to the two elections in accord with the government's propaganda needs," end quote. So here we see that when those in American power don't like a third world regime, then the media focuses on how their elections were corrupt. And if American power likes a particular regime, then the media reports the elections as being fair. And in fact, when in reality, very likely the opposite in this case was true. And so that's another example of this massive bias. And, you know, you might think, oh, that's not going to happen today. That only happened back then.
Our intelligence community just came out and said in the last few days that the Kremlin, meaning Putin and the Russian government, are directing the attacks, the hacking on American accounts to influence our election. And WikiLeaks is part of that, as are other sites where the Russians hack information. We don't even know if it's accurate information. And then they put it out. We have never in the history of our country been in a situation where an adversary, a foreign power, is working so hard to influence the outcome of the election. And believe me, they're not doing it to get me elected.
Russia hacked the election, Dave, and this is continually repeated in the media.
To influence our election.
The Trump-Russia scandal.
There was clearly some collusion.
Cooperation and collusion.
So if the Democrats like the outcome, it's the election is fair. But if they don't like the outcome, it's Russia. The U.S. uses it in the third world, and they're using it at home, Dave.
Yeah, which used to be illegal, but those laws got set aside under Obama, so it's fair game abroad. It's fair game at home, I guess.
Yeah, you know, and actually, I think one time I saw this clip where Chomsky's asked about the Russian interference in the elections. And he says, you know, the Russians, people are always interfering in people's elections or trying to, but Russia has a very little impact on American elections. But America is out there actually overthrowing different leaders of the world. you know, and installing new dictators. I mean, they're doing this all over the Middle East. They go do this in Africa. They're doing it all over the place. And they're worried about Russian interference in their elections. How ridiculous.
Yeah, that's right. Think about what's going on in Venezuela right now.
Yeah.
And with the contesting of the election of Maduro and the U.S. now backing the contestant, essentially.
Yes, that's right. No, it's a total gong show. And notice how the whole world is getting involved in there. And of course, it's worthwhile to know that Venezuela has actually a lot of resources that people might be interested in.
That's right. Chinese, Russians, there's a lot of involvement down there.
That's right. So I guess the media, it's clear that the media is biased. And we've given some examples, and there are a lot more. You can go see Chomsky for that. But the question is the following. Are people in the press, the reporters, censoring themselves? And wouldn't there have to be some sort of a conspiracy for them to all be working together and agreeing on the talking points? And Chomsky actually addresses this. He starts by talking about George Orwell and his views about censorship. And here's a quote from, this is not from the Marr interview, this is from a different lecture that Chomsky gave.
The introduction to Animal Farm was called Literary Censorship in England. And what it says is that, obviously this book is, carries, it's ridiculing the Soviet Union and its...
By the way, this is George Orwell's Animal Farm that he's talking about.
...totalitarian structure. But he said England's not all that different. I mean, we're a free society, we don't have the KGB on our neck, but the end result comes out pretty much the same. He says people who have independent ideas or who think the wrong kind of thoughts are cut out of the, you know, they're removed from reaching the public in one or another fashion. And then he gives some examples and so on. Then he talks a little bit, he has only a few sentences of analysis as to why it happens. I mean, what I'm talking about now, the institutional structure, actually has two sentences. He says, why does this happen? He says, well, one, because the press is owned by wealthy men who only want certain things to reach the public, which is, you know, a very brief way of saying what I was saying in a complicated way. And the other thing he said is that when you go through the elite education system, like you go through the proper schools and you end up in Oxford and, you know, and so on, the path to entering into the top of the society, you go through this, you just learn that there are certain things that it's not proper to say, and in fact there are certain thoughts that it's not proper to have. Well, that's the socialization role of the elite institutions, and if you don't adapt to that, you're usually out.
So it's not a self-censorship. It's a systematic selection and perhaps even a self-selection that occurs so that by the time you're sort of advanced and working in the system, you've adopted the beliefs of the institutions.
Yeah, and in a way, this makes complete sense, right? For example, in the church, we don't want men preaching from pulpits who don't believe what our church believes, teaches, and confesses. So
precisely,
the system selects, you self-select, and in the end, you need to be certified, and that applies for much more than theological training.
Yeah, it's a natural property. Yeah, it's a natural property of institutions, right, that have a certain message that they want to propel. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And here's just an interesting kind of a quote from the Marr interview that relates to this from Chomsky.
How can you know that I'm self-censoring? How can you know that journalists are...
I don't say self-censoring. I'm sure you believe everything you're saying. But what I'm saying is if you believe something different, you wouldn't be sitting where you're sitting.
So if you believe something different, you wouldn't be sitting where you're sitting. That's one of my favorite quotes from Chomsky here, just illustrating that by the time you're in that interviewer's chair, you have a very certain set of beliefs that you're adhering to, and you're working from a very particular worldview that then you're propagating to your audience.
Yeah, definitely. I've got a book here. I just pulled it off the shelf. I think this is the book. It's Darwin Day in America by John G. West. And he talks about...
That's a great book.
He talks about... I think this is the book where he talks about... he gives a bunch of examples where, for example, law schools are filtering out, making sure that if you're Christian, you can't go and get your law degree. They'll figure out a way to flunk you no matter how good you are, because they're trying to create a certain worldview that fills that that profession.
Yeah, that's a really interesting book, actually. I have a quote here from Manufacturing Consent again, and it's about media biasing and how it occurs. He says, quote, "This is normally not achieved by crude intervention, but by the selection of right-thinking personnel and by the editors and working journalists' internalization of priorities and definitions of newsworthiness that conform to the institution's policy." So it's, again, it's this idea that it's kind of baked into the system.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Dave, I could see this actually, you know, happening at the university, because if you're a student who holds, you know, what might be called unauthorized views, who openly questions, let's say, evolution or materialism, which is the belief that only physical matter exists. If you believe that people have a soul, which is a belief called dualism. If you, for instance, would question progressivism or maybe some religions like Islam or transgender ideology in some places, then you're likely not going to get a good reference letter. You might not be able to get a good position at an influential institution, and you'll just kind of be deselected or selected out of the system. And, you know, at the faculty level, I think we simply won't hire someone that doesn't follow closely to the accepted methods or views or approaches that are currently in place.
Yeah, and I think in today's climate of, it's one thing to guarantee a certain standard of professionalism and, you know, for and adherence, especially, you know, as from a theological perspective to our church's theological teachings, but it's another when the world has become so polarized that this now becomes a way to censor different viewpoints out.
Yeah, and it feels like it's very systemic. It's like throughout the entire system, right? So it's colleagues, quote unquote, censoring colleagues, right? Because if you try to dissent from something later in your career, you're going to be sort of ostracized. There's also the role of the government, because the government have various funding priorities. And so if you're applying for research grants, you really do have to address topics that they're interested in. Otherwise, you're less likely to get money. So there's biasing there. Universities, of course, are beholden to major donors, and this is a particularly big problem in the United States. And so they get to say what their money's being spent on, what the special initiatives might be. And so it seems like it's just from all over the place, all different sides, there's a systematic control and biasing that happens. And the intellectuals are essentially there just as these middle managers of information that have already conformed to the system. Otherwise, they wouldn't be there. I mean, it's quite pathetic, actually. I feel terrible about myself.
Well, it is what it is. You can't escape it just about anywhere you go now. That's what we're facing with, right?
Yeah, I guess you just have to sort of work within the constraints and try to minimize the extent to which you're influenced and kind of directed by all these different forces. And related to this, I have a clip from a lecture where Chomsky talks about the conformist pressures in the universities.
I mean, the universities, for example, are not independent institutions. I mean, like there may be independent people scattered around in them, but that's true of the media, it's true of the corporations, it's true of fascist states for that matter. But the institution itself is parasitic. It's dependent on outside sources of support, and those sources of support are not, you know, like Z Magazine or 95% of the population in the country. They're private wealth, big corporations with grants, the government, which is itself so closely interlinked with corporate power that you can barely distinguish them. That's essentially what the university is in the middle of. And people within them who don't
adjust to that structure and accept it and usually internalize it, because you can't really work with it unless you internalize it and believe it. People who don't do that are likely to be weeded out along the way, actually starting from kindergarten, you know, all the way up. There's all sorts of filtering devices that get rid of people who are a pain in the neck and think independently and so on and so forth, and you end up with you've all been through college and you know that the whole educational system is very highly geared to rewarding conformity and obedience. I mean, if you don't do that, you're a troublemaker and so on. So it's kind of a filtering device, which ends up with people who really honestly, they're not lying, you know, they honestly internalize the framework of belief and attitudes of the surrounding of the power system in the society. The real elite institutions, like, say, Harvard and Princeton and the upscale small colleges, for example, I mean, they're very much geared to socialization. I don't know if you happen to have been in them, but if you go through, say, a place like Harvard, most of what goes on there is teaching you manners. So how to behave like a member of the upper classes and how to think the right thoughts and so on and so forth.
So, of course, I don't want to poo-poo the university because, you know, I'm a faculty member at a university. But it's very important to think about the university clearly and to understand the various constraints that are within the system. So, Dave, what's one way that you can tell that a particular media agency is a propaganda machine or that they're heavily into propaganda?
Well, one, I think it's Jacques Ellul who points this out. He was a French philosopher and political scientist who I unpacked one of his other books, but he's got the book Propaganda, The Formation of Men's Attitudes. And I believe he was the one to point out that it's not just about controlling the information that goes out, that's on message. You also need to control access to information that is contrary to that message.
Yeah, I can grab his book here just a second and grab a couple of quotes here. Yeah, so he writes the following. He says about good propaganda, he says, it will prevent the individual from finding external points of reference. And also, he says, it protects him by censoring everything that might come in from the outside.
Right.
So just as you say, it's not only that it feeds you sanctioned information, but it also blocks you from accessing any dissenting information.
Yeah, and this is the key to what we'll talk about is learning how to ask the right questions and looking at different viewpoints, because often the propaganda is sort of, it's tenuous in some points. And if you just simply ask a few intelligent questions, or if you simply come across a wider fact set, and later on we can talk about video clips and their impact maybe on the next episode. If you just watch the wider video clip, you'll see that actually, no, this is not the full picture, but then, and that's why it becomes very important to block any other sources that will be contrary to what the message is. And that's why we're seeing this big kind of media, I hate to say the word witch hunt, but it's mm-hmm. probably appropriate word on any media that is now supposedly fake news or conspiracy, or anybody that's willing to present a point of view or facts that contradict what is meant to go out.
Yeah. So in terms of this kind of blocking of access to information, here's a clip in which CNN's Chris Cuomo reveals his view about how people are allowed to access information. And this is related to the WikiLeaks that were released a while ago.
Also interesting is, remember, it's illegal to possess these stolen documents. It's different for the media. So everything you learn about this, you're learning from us. And in full disclosure, let's take a look at what is in there and what it means.
So he says it's different for the media. It's illegal for you to possess or read the documents. And that's really interesting, because he says, look, you shouldn't be accessing this. And in fact, if you do, you're essentially committing a crime.
And we have to be very concerned when the mainstream media is trying to, you know, broadly speaking, to be the sole source of information or to hold a monopoly on being the sole filter through which information is passed.
And then he goes on to say that he says, quote, and in full disclosure, let's take a look. And here he's essentially saying he's going to give you a full disclosure. And I guess, I mean, it's a large bit of information. So he's saying at least an unbiased and accurate summary of the information, right? And of course, we're trying to make the case. Of course, he's not going to give you that, especially when he's now just blocked you from actually or discouraged you from accessing the original information. So there you see it kind of in full force and its naked fullness right out in the open, how they're trying to block access to information.
And in fact, if you followed this stuff, you would have noticed that the stuff that they focused on was relatively benign and kind of banal. And it was other alt media sources that highlighted the juicy stuff, the stuff that was incriminating, the stuff that was the real dumps of the WikiLeaks. And of course, so I mean, you have two choices. You either go to the primary sources yourself, or you find other sources that can highlight things for you that are different from what the mainstream media is deciding to focus on.
Here's another clip from Morning Joe, an MSNBC morning show with Mika Brzezinski and Joe Scarborough. And this is Mika talking. Listen very carefully.
He's trying to undermine the media, trying to make up his own facts. And it could be that while unemployment and the economy worsens, he could have undermined the messaging so much that he can actually control exactly what people think. And that is our job.
Dave, I want you to hear that the ending there very clearly. Let's see if we can hear it again. Listen to this.
Right. Exactly what people think. And that is our job.
That is our job, Dave.
Yeah, I think she kind of misspoke there, because she tried to, the truth always wants to get out, right? And so she tried to dial this back on Twitter or something like that, as I recall.
Yeah.
But that's what they're scared about, is that Trump, whether you agree with him or not, because of his understanding, his media savvy, is going to wrest control of the messaging from them.
Yeah, absolutely. This is exactly the point. And by the way, Dave, do you know who Mika Brzezinski's father is?
Yeah, I don't even know how to pronounce his last name. It's Zbigniew or something like that.
Yeah, Zbigniew. That's his first name. Yeah, Zbigniew.
And I mean, this guy was very active. He was on Carter's national security. He was an advisor.
Yeah.
He was also big on the Council of Foreign Relations, and we'll have to kind of dig into some of these supposedly beneficial
groups.
Groups at some point, not today, but he was basically a propaganda guy.
Yeah, and he wrote a book, Between Two Ages: America's Role in the Technotronic Era, and in there he made a bunch of predictions. It's actually maybe worth discussing that book later on in the future.
Yeah, sounds good.
Now, maybe just before our time runs out here, because we're almost just coming up to an hour here, but let's very quickly just take a look at one solution that people often put forward. They say, well, you know, if the media is basically biased because it's a big business, it's a capitalist big business, well, maybe one solution is to just publicly fund the media, use government to fund the media. But of course, that's also problematic. Here in Canada, we have the CBC, which is funded by the government, but it's heavily, heavily left-leaning. And I don't know if you heard about this, Dave, but recently Prime Minister Trudeau announced that the Liberal government will be giving money to fund media outlets. And of course, they'll receive the funding if they meet very specific standards. And I have a little clip here, actually, of an exchange between Conservative MP Peter Kent and Justin Trudeau in the Canadian Parliament. Take a listen.
Mr. Speaker, it's been a week since the Liberals announced their undefined, mistargeted, temporary patch, $600 million plus election year bailout for Canada's struggling news industry. Owners and publishers who get million-dollar checks and bonuses, and partisan big union bosses, not surprisingly, praise the bailout. But dozens of this country's most respected journalists have denounced it because it casts a dark shadow over the independence of their craft. Mr. Speaker, does the Prime Minister now understand how acceptable this bailout is in an election year?
Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, a free and independent press is the cornerstone of any democracy. We understand that. We also understand that the transformation of the news industry and the digital challenges...
Sounds like he's going to have a heart attack there, you know, he's like, it's or a hyperventilate or something.
Facing require new models to support a strong independent journalism, and that's why our government is choosing to step up to defend the independence and the strength and the capacity of journalists to do their job in this country. We know that attacking journalists, as the members opposite like to do, is not the way to strengthen our democracy. We will support the capacity of journalists to do their job independently.
The Honourable Member for Thornhill.
You hear that, eh? To do their job independently. So they're going to fund them to do their job independently. Let's listen to the rest of it.
Well, Mr. Speaker, it is clear from that answer that the Prime Minister doesn't understand the economic and technological realities that have created this crisis for our free and independent Canadian news industry. This bailout, Mr. Speaker, isn't a long-term remedy. It's a temporary patch which ignores, for example, suggestions from the Public Policy Forum, like ending tax write-offs for advertisers on foreign digital platforms or resizing the mandate of Canada's semi-private public broadcaster. Mr. Speaker, why won't the Prime Minister listen to Canada's independent journalists?
Yeah. The Honourable Prime Minister.
Speaker, the conspiracy theory being peddled by Conservatives is insulting to the intelligence of Canadians and to the professionalism of journalists. The Conservatives think Canadian journalists can be bought. We don't. We know their work is essential to our democracy. France, Sweden, Germany, the UK, and many others took action to support journalism without compromising its independence. But newspapers are going through a crisis. That's why we're taking action right now to help them get through this crisis and continue to stay strong and defend our democracy the way they always do.
Oh, he gets an applause, yeah. He gets an applause from the other Liberals. But what do you think, Dave? Any opportunity for bias here?
Well, you can guarantee that any dissenting voices are not going to get a penny of this money. You're not going to see Rebel Media getting any coin. You're not going to see Press for Truth getting any coin, any of this money.
Yeah.
And anybody else, you know, anybody else that the reality is that our news, both in print and on the TV in Canada, is very leftist oriented, because they've already done such a great job of squashing any meaningful counter voices.
And of course, the Trudeau group, they're claiming that they're going to appoint a nonpartisan special panel to oversee to whom funding is to be given. But of course, other people argue that this panel itself is going to be biased. And I got just a couple quotes here from Andrew Coyne from the National Post. In the article, he writes the following about this problem with this biased panel or this unbiased panel, so to speak. So he says, of course, no one would be so crude as to attach any explicit quid pro quo. No government would be so foolish as to take a direct hand in doling out the money or to demand favorable coverage in return. On the other hand, you can't just give out the tax credits to everybody. Not in the world where anyone can post to the web and call himself a publisher. So someone has to choose, but who? And he goes on to say, the government's blackly brilliant answer, an independent panel of journalists will determine who is eligible to receive the government's cash. Of course, make the inmates fight amongst themselves. Let decisions about which journalists get to keep their jobs be made by other journalists. Who can blame the government then? That sounds like academia, actually. This sort of peer review process where you blackball other people because, you know, and you're their peer. So everybody says that's fair. And then let me just get right to the final quote here. This is the money quote. He says, just so we're clear, I don't actually think the government will appoint a group of card-carrying liberal hacks to this independent panel. They won't need to. If the example of the liberal-appointed independent senators is any guide, they will be scrupulously nonpartisan, of unimpeachable respectability, and dependably progressive. Dependably progressive,
progressive,
Dave.
Yeah, exactly. Hilarious. And since you know, journalists see the internet and alt media sources that are found on the internet as a threat to them, how much funding do you think they're going to get?
Right? Yeah, and I don't know if you heard this, Dave, in the quote there, but Trudeau actually claimed the criticism to be a conspiracy theory.
That's right. This is, we'll have to dig into the origins of this term conspiracy theory if we can get some good material on it, because it seems to be the way anybody is sidelined. You don't have to have an argument. You can just name somebody. You can say, oh, you're a conspiracy theorist. Somehow your facts are to be discounted at that point, or you're a racist, or you're a Nazi, and all your arguments are invalid at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm thinking of a program that the Liberals put in place. I think it was called the Canada Summer Jobs Program, and they had some stipulation there where they would only give money to organizations who do not support anti-abortion views, and so who supported specifically liberal worldviews.
That's right. You couldn't get the grant. In fact, Trudeau does not allow anyone in his party to hold a pro-life position.
Yeah. I mean, the bias is there, left, right, and center. Dave, is there anything else you want to point out here about media bias before we bring this episode to a close? I noticed we're already past the hour.
Yeah, well, let's leave it here, and we'll pick it up on the other side in episode 2.
Yeah, and I hear our music playing in the background. Let's maybe summarize some of the key points, the key message that we tried to communicate today. And here's the key message. While the media might present themselves as being honest and as being unbiased sources of information, their structure and their interaction with power centers of society make them into inherent peddlers of propaganda. And they're going to try to control our access to information, and they will exert pressure on us to conform to their worldview. And maybe the message here is we've got to resist. We've got to arm ourselves with knowledge. We've got to learn about what's going on. We must not conform. And with that, Dave, I say over and out.